Cohen? This is the House Labor and Commerce Committee. It's November 28th, about 9:30, and it's the business before us today is we're going to have a work session on several pieces of legislation. First on the agenda, we're going to be taking up proposed changes to the landlord-tenant law, which is a House Labor and Commerce Committee bill, House Bill 309. And present today is Chairman Donnelly, and we expect other committee members to be here soon. There's been an unfortunate development with a large group of folks that attended to testify today, and that there was a death of a very prominent member of the Landlord Property Managers Association, and because of funeral arrangements, a lot of those folks aren't going to be here today. I'd like to start the testimony today with Robert Hickerson. Robert, you don't have to sit there. You might want to sit off to the side somewhere so it would be easier for people in the back to hear you. If you're just facing me, you can even come up here if you want anywhere. Yeah. We find that if you're just talking this direction, it's really hard for people back there to hear you or see you.
I don't want to presume it's the Representative Lehman seat.
Yeah. Since the tape's going, I'm not going to take it back. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robert Hickerson. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Legal Services Corporation. Alaska Legal Services Corporation is the primary law firm that represents tenants in eviction cases throughout the state. And it's in part based on our experience in landlord-tenant cases that I'm appearing before you this morning. Rather than Representative Lehman,
Well, we've got a break here. The record should reflect we've been joined by Representative Lehman.
Morning.
My landlord tenant.
Am I on that already?
Yeah. Well, that's who's here to testify. Oh, so.
Okay. I think rather than, Mr. Chairman, rather than plow through a litany of the technical provisions at this time, I will talk about the themes that I see emerging in the bill and then make some recommendations. And I'd like to reserve the right to submit a more detailed sectional analysis at a later time. In some sense, I'm a surrogate for the lawyers who do most landlord-tenant work for our law firm. And since practice varies from court to court throughout the state, it's our hope that we can sort of make some uniform comment that would be relevant to every court in the state. My experience is more particular to Anchorage, and from what I'm hearing, practice and application of certain provisions of the existing Landlord-Tenant Act do vary greatly depending on whether you're in an urban setting or a rural setting. In any event, the bill as a whole is a landlord's bill. I have seen one analysis that suggests it's a landlord-tenant bill. It's clear to me that the theme of this legislation is to make eviction easier for landlords. That's the clear theme that emerges. Perhaps that's in the public interest. I would argue that it's not. There is, however, one good part to the bill, and I'll start with what I see as the good provisions, and I'll talk a little bit about what I think are the bad ones. But certainly the good provision that I see in the bill is Section 6A, which allows for claims to be heard at one hearing if they're uncomplicated. So often the case is that tenants have counterclaims, have claims based upon habitability of the workplace, perhaps claims related to security deposits, other matters that by and large are not heard at the initial setting. The way it's set up, only the issue of possession is heard at the initial hearing, and consequently those claims then get calendared on a docket which oftentimes is a year or 2 years or a year and a half in advance. And the reality for many tenants is that those claims never get heard because there's not an opportunity to put on that evidence at a time that it's fresh and relevant. That part of the bill, I think, would be acceptable to the tenant community. The rest of the bill, unfortunately, I think, would be objectionable in every regard to the tenant community. Basically, what it attempts to do is to shorten the time periods between the time that notices are served and summonses are served and court proceedings take place. the same reason why it's difficult in the existing setting to for tenants to gather evidence and put on a case in a landlord-tenant is already complicated. If you shorten those time frames from 10 to 3 or 4 to 2 days, the problem for a client and a lawyer in terms of preparing a defense, which sometimes is different from that stated in the original summons. For example, sometimes non-payment of rent is cited as the reason for the eviction because it triggers a shorter notice period. The tenant has no idea exactly why they're being evicted. They come to court only to find that there may be a technical default in the rent, but in reality, the landlord wants a new tenant or has some other basis for seeking the eviction. And putting on that kind of a case in that short time frame is difficult as it is for the tenant and would be compounded if those time periods are shortened. The other, I think, social implications of what you do if you shorten those time periods are that there's a number of people in Alaska who live on a fixed income of one kind or another. That income stream sometimes gets interrupted, and sometimes temporarily, so that you put, again, a shorter time frame within which people can rehabilitate their financial situation, seek assistance from others, be it a church or a benevolent organization, seek vendor payments through the general relief system, which the state has, and although that's a fairly streamlined system, it still requires some time to pass before those applications can be made, and it's not triggered, as I understand it, until an eviction notice is actually served. It's then when a tenant can go to general relief if they have a disability or low income and seek a vendor payment to rehabilitate the rental situation. 10 days, it seems like, in our mind, is effective in the sense that those kinds of attempts can be made. And I understand it's the practice in Juneau, for example, that 9 to 10 days is about what it takes if you're going to solicit a payment of some sort from some organization or through the state vendor program. I spoke briefly about the lack of evidence and how that compounds the problem in presenting a defense. There is what appears to be a sort of after-former rule included in there, which would dramatically shorten the time periods if someone has been involved in an eviction proceeding, and I'm not sure exactly what kind of proof would be put on or how that would work. I think that there is a social risk in some sense to compounding the problem of homelessness if these time periods are shortened. And it's not only because of the situation where somebody has a fixed income or a sporadic income, and that income stream is interrupted, that they might be able to rehabilitate their situation, but they also, it gives them an opportunity to plan for where they're going to be when they hit the streets, and certainly that's going to be the result, ultimately, of the eviction proceeding where somebody doesn't have enough money to pay rent. It does happen sometimes that in that intervening period of 10 days and then service and so forth, which I'm sure the landlord community would say amounts to about 30 days in some instances, it's in that period that people would have an opportunity to either plan to join a relative, make some other arrangement, without ending up on the streets and then turning to the shelters or whatever else is provided for folks without a roof over their head. I'm not entirely certain what has prompted this legislation, what testimony came to the committee which formed the basis for the bill. I suspect that from reading the provisions that it's a frustration with the time periods that as they do play out with the court system, and hence the desire as reflected in the legislation to shorten those periods. I'm not sure what the problem is. If that's it, I don't see, and of course I don't see it from that perspective, but I don't see that there is tremendous abuse going on. I don't see that people are not being evicted ultimately, or that landlords have not been able to use the procedures effectively in terms of freeing up their rental properties. Our argument would be that the current bill or the current legislation is not broke and consequently does not need a fix. With that overview,
not move out of committee. But if the committee's will to advance this bill, I would suggest some other matters to be considered if, in fact, the committee wants to produce a truly balanced bill. One suggestion I would have is that, particularly if you're going to allow for 3 months advanced rent and security deposits, I would suggest that some provision be made for paying interest to tenants on those security deposits, which landlords hold sometimes for 3 or 4 years. I would suggest that in addition to your provision, which would allow tenants to pay directly to a bank to avoid double payments in the situation where the landlord is in foreclosure or about to go into foreclosure, I would suggest that some protection be considered which would require banks or financial institutions to honor leases that are in effect and to allow those tenants, particularly when the lease is in a favorable context, to honor that tenancy through the term of the lease. That's an issue that we've seen come through our doors and without any protection or resolution. The third thing that I would
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could you repeat that last one?
Okay.
Was that last one your second one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Issue is that there is an attempt in this bill, which I would suggest is a good attempt, to allow tenants to pay directly to financial institutions to avoid.
I think we've got, in one of the revisions of it, I think we tried to address that issue. I don't know if...
Is it in section, what would be section 5 of the bill? No, that's not it.
Let's give us a second here, because I'd really like to hear your comments about whether you think what we... Because I think we tried to address that. I'd like to hear your comments whether you think that works for that or not.
And the record should reflect we've been joined by Representatives Finkelstein and Boucher.
Are you lucky?
I thought it was in the early early portions here.
Because I know that's been raised as a problem in the past where somebody else takes over the property. And
the listed owner keeps getting the payments and it's basically going down a rat hole.
Yeah, and also that what happens to the security deposit, the former owner had it, mm-hmm. The new owner doesn't. How do they get their security deposit back?
Well, I can't find that provision.
I remember discussing that.
We talked about that.
We did talk about it. I remember, and I like both these ideas.
And I think we had incorporated that in the proposed committee substitute, too. We were trying to figure that out.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you like that, but I thought we could find it. I think it's in the committee substitute, though, Mr. Harrison, so it wouldn't be in that.
It's not the one. I picked up one this morning.
Yes, it's the original bill, so okay. We have a proposed committee substitute. I think we rolled that provision to take care of that into.
I saw it in another provision, but what I'm speaking of is actually something slightly different.
Okay.
And that's the situation. There is case law on this issue in commercial leases, mm-hmm. And the case law is that if you're a commercial lessee and your lessor defaults on his obligation to a financial institution, you have a 10-year lease, let's say, and your lessor defaults. Under existing case law, your lease is terminated upon default of your lessor, and you have no right. Let's say you're in the first month of the 10-year lease, uh-huh. In a very favorable term. You have no right under that lease at that point. And I suspect that in the commercial setting, that's a fair way to do it. The guy goes in, if somebody's offering me a cheap lease, maybe he ought to wonder why such a good rate and so forth. And the burden perhaps should be on the businessman to say, well, this is a good term, but if the bank takes over, I know I'm running the risk that I'll have no rights to this 10-year lease at all. But I'm suggesting in the residential setting, that's an unfair result, that it shouldn't be the burden of the tenant to inquire about the Dun & Bradstreet rating of the landlord, to assume the risk that this landlord, when they enter a 3-year lease, let's say, or a year lease at a favorable rate, that they're not going to be at the sole whim of the financial institution if the landlord
breaches their financial obligation.
What do you think would be a reasonable period of time to require that they honor leases? You think 1 year period?
I think a 1 year period, 6 months to a year, 6 months on the short end, a year probably on the long end, in the sense that at least that would give folks an opportunity. And we're talking about people who are not in default in any way on their rental obligation. They just happen to have rented from the wrong person. That's a result I think that would be fair. And while I can't find a specific provision we're talking about, I don't think that addresses that same issue.
Okay.
The one other matter which I'll mention is that Congress passed an act in 1988 called the Fair Housing Amendments Act.
And I haven't had an opportunity to set the two laws closely to side by side to compare, but I know that there is a mandate in that bill to require states to bring their laws into compliance with the Fair Housing Amendments Act. I don't think that any of those provisions relate directly to eviction procedures. I think they do relate to access for handicapped individuals, for married individuals with children, set some standards for housing that I know are subsidized by the federal government, but I believe also insured by one of the major insurers, be it our financial, government financial institution. And with the idea that additional recommendations or analysis would be provided in writing, we'll attempt to make that comparison as well and give you the benefit of our analysis in terms of whether additional changes, if we're in the process of making changes, would be desirable in terms of bringing state law into compliance with those amendments. That's all
good.
I have.
That'd be real helpful. Yeah. Members of the committee have any questions?
I just have a comment, and I don't know that it's a widespread clamor. I do get comments now and then from people who are concerned about the existing landlord-tenant law, and your suggestion that it may just be a landlord law, I think it maybe is a little bit unfair. I think there are some changes that could be made. I was caught in the middle of the existing landlord-tenant law, and I think you and I discussed this, and I think it was an unfair situation that maybe some corrections can be applied to it, and we can make it more fair while we're not unnecessarily harming those who legitimately need the protection, either of the state or the public protection. So I see some of these changes as being good changes and being fair, I think, for society in general. I'm hopeful we can work out something that, where you can look at it and say it may not be everything I want, but at least it is a fair approach to this process.
We'll be happy to assist.
Robert, sorry I came in late during the testimony. In summary, what section do you object to in the bill?
Well, I think in summary, actually my presentation was very summary. I suggested that I liked, and that the tenant community would like Section 6A, and that virtually the rest of the bill would be objectionable. Those objections varied from strong objections to what is the purpose of this provision, those sorts of concerns, and with the chair's permission, we will be submitting a detailed sectional analysis that would include, and I think this is important, would include a review to some extent by folks who practice all around the state. I think that it's important to realize that this bill will have application in every part of the state, and the practice does vary dramatically depending on how accessible courts are, how often dockets are set, and such issues like that. It would be with the benefit of at least from the tenant point of view, comments from lawyers who practice in all the courts in the state that we submit that. I suggested as well that other issues that might be looked into would be interest on security deposits, some protection for tenants who are caught in the middle of a foreclosure arrangement, and a review of the act to seek compliance with the Fair Housing Amendments Act, the federal legislation in 1988.
fills apart which parts of the bill are most objectionable.
Well, the theme of the bill is to make eviction easier. And by and large, what that means is shortening all of the time periods. There's an attempt to shorten all the time periods to move landlord-tenant cases to the top of the docket, to make all of those existing provisions shorter and easier from the landlord's point of view. My assessment of that is that that will create problems for tenants. It will make it difficult for them to prepare evidence at those hearings to resist eviction. It will complicate the situation for folks on a fixed income who have a temporary income interruption of one kind or another, where existing time periods generally provide enough time for income situations to be rehabilitated. It does happen. There's also an interplay with seeking vendor payments from the state for general relief payments to a landlord. That short time period makes it very difficult to get that paperwork done and to rehabilitate the situation. I think it will exacerbate homelessness, not only from the standpoint it will put more people on the street, but those people have less opportunity to plan for where they're going to be next when they are evicted. This is kind of a rehash. I guess that the other thing I'd say is it's not just fixed income people. To some extent, the boom and bust syndrome of the Alaska economy has made in certain years, maybe not recent years, but has made in certain years investment in rental property a lucrative venture. I think that by the same token, it's that same boom and bust economy which leads to sporadic income flows for people who rent. They may pay high rents in periods of rapid growth, but that income stream is sporadic. And the nature of the situation in Alaska, that's probably the way it's going to be indefinitely. And to the extent that these time periods are shortened, I think it puts a burden even on folks who perhaps are not in the fixed income area.
The interest on security deposit suggestion, I thought that was already in the law. That isn't in the law? There's no requirement of interest on deposit?
No. It's required, as I recall, it's required that they be maintained in a segregated account so that you don't have commingling and you don't run the risk that the person's going to lose it because the security deposits are being used to make mortgage payments or something. They're supposed to be segregated, and there's a penalty for not doing that. But there is currently no interest paid. And as I suggested, if the bill allows for prepayment of up to 3 months' rent, you're talking about $3,000 or $4,000. Somebody maintains a tenancy for 3 or 4 years, that could be a fair amount of money.
Okay. Great. Well, I appreciate your vote or all this stuff again.
Why not say it a second time?
Robert, I had some questions. Number one, I think a lot of your concerns, and you talked a little bit differently just now, I recognize, have to do with low-income folks.
Right.
And the Act, as it is now, clearly is written to protect low-income folks. I think it's really not, it really doesn't address well in the marketplace the higher-income levels of things. And that's pretty much noted when I look at it, say for a dwelling, just a house. You rented somebody a $500,000 house, you're still limited to 2 months' worth of security. And it seems to me when you move up to the upper income levels, there's a real clear argument that you, when you're dealing with somebody who can afford a $500,000 house, these people ought to have the freedom to contract for a year in advance and take a bulk payment for a year, and they ought to have the freedom to contract for the maintenance of that house, which the Act currently prohibits too, that you would put the burden on whoever's living there to do the maintenance and maintain the house much more so than the Act currently affords. Now, I'd really appreciate if when you do your review and do your analysis, if you would tell me those areas where you think that would be there's a logical public policy distinction between lower income and higher income for those things, because I just don't think it makes any sense to prohibit parties in that kind of economic, because they could both afford their own lawyers, for God's sakes, to be able to make those kind of contracts. Right, when it's something where you're dealing with a house or you know, a more expensive dwelling. So I'd really appreciate it if you could dichotomize on those.
I certainly don't pretend to comment on that situation.
Yeah, well, and see, the Act as it's written now covers that as well as, you know, $100 a month rental, and it just doesn't seem to make sense. you know, that those people don't have the economic know-how to make those kind of decisions for themselves. You know?
I certainly think people should be free to contract as they see fit. By the same token, I don't see a lot of those cases in forcible entry and detainer court. But
That's right. You don't see them from your perspective. So what I'd like you to do is note this may be different in a different situation, okay? And you might not oppose it in those situations if you sat down and thought about it, too.
Probably would have no concern about
that. Right, right. So if you could dichotomize between those, that might be real useful to the committee. There might be areas that we'd all agree on there. Second, there's an interest that's been shown in Seattle. In fact, they're working on a new eviction law that would allow landlords to more expeditiously evict tenants they suspect of dealing drugs. And if your folks could take a look at some of those laws statewide, in other states or other areas, and tell us if there's anything that you could agree to that this committee could roll into a bill. And we've started working on it, but I'd sure like your advice on that. That would be, you know, in your opinion, wouldn't violate the innocent tenants' rights, but would still let us get to this problem of crack houses and drug houses in our neighborhoods and allow landlords to take some action in that. I'd really appreciate it if you could give us some advice on that. Those are my two points. And I'll look forward, the sooner you can get us your section-by-section comments, we'd really appreciate it.
Chairman, could I get a plug-in for the Commission on the Future of the Permanent Code? How many people do you have in your office?
Locally, 26.
I'm going to give you 26 of these. It doesn't cost you a thing except the pencil. We're looking to get input from people throughout the state. We've got pretty close to 5,000 of these back. We'd like to hear from your people.
Very
simple
welcome.
Five-page summary of what the fund's all about. Because we're the ones that get beat over the head with questions of what we should do and what we shouldn't do, and that would be a big help. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14. Excuse me.
20 is close enough.
All right. 16, 8, there we go.
He's going to keep tracking.
I'm just counting on you.
He'll probably will be published in the paper. Well, I can fill all these out, I guess.
No, thank you very much.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
No, it's very serious business. Your help would be appreciated.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Chair. Alice Brewer? Do you want to just join us over here? It's really easier for folks over there to hear you. It's closer. I ought to just do away with that table.
And you don't have to worry about speaking into the mic.
Yeah, because we're not on teleconference
anyway
today.
No, it'll pick up anything. You don't have to worry about getting closer to it.
Thank you, Representative Donnelly.
Okay, I'm Alice Brewer, and I'm the Vice President of Alaska Landlord and Property Managers Association, which is a small group of landlords who clean their own ovens and do a lot of their own repairs and that type of thing. If you want to see a mom-and-pop type organization, I think that's most of our members. And as you noted before, our executive secretary's funeral is this afternoon, and we have one member here. Undoubtedly, that's what's kept some of the other members away. We certainly appreciate having this bill brought up at this time. The previous one was during the pipeline building days, which was definitely slanted toward the tenant. And now, perhaps in our time of need, when so many people have lost their property because of the oil prices going down and so forth, this is a very appropriate time to look at the other side. And I don't really know that we should bear the societal burden of taking care of people who cannot pay for their lodgings. Maybe someplace else in society there is a burden for that, but we are small people. now, we some of the people did have concerns about various aspects of this bill. And it's on my page 3. I don't know if it's on your copy of the...
Is this the...
this has to do with a security deposit.
This is the original bill? Here's
6-0846A.
Okay, good. That's all we need. Now we know where we're at. Thank you.
Okay. Line 23. If the landlord or tenant gives notice that complies with the statute, the landlord shall mail written notice and refund required by D of this section within 14 days after the tenancy is terminated and possession is delivered by the tenant to the address supplied by the tenant. Our people felt that they would like to have 30 days instead of the 14 days there in order to return the deposit because they felt that they needed more time to get people in to make estimates of damage, get two bids maybe on replacing the carpet or the formica or whatever it was. They really felt that that was necessary. Mm. Okay, page 7. Well, it starts with 6 and 7 here. On B, during an absence of the tenant in excess of 7 days, the landlord may enter the dwelling unit at times reasonably necessary and so forth and so on. The landlord may re-enter the dwelling unit and terminate the rental agreement. This is added material. When the rent has not been paid, the tenant failed to give the landlord notice of the absence, and the tenant, one in a week-to-week tenancy, has been absent for 3 days, and two in a month-to-month tenancy has been absent for 10 days. We would like that 10 days shortened to either 7 days, corresponding with the 7 days over here on page 6, or even 3 days corresponding to the week-to-week tenancy. Yeah, I think all in all, the group of people at that came to the ALPA meeting were pleased with the law and sees that the bill and sees that it really fulfills a need at this time.
Okay.
Running for it.
Okay. Questions from members of the committee?
I'll just repeat what you were here when I made my previous comment, I think, and that's what I'm hearing too. That there's a time when we need to come back to normalcy. This may be the time. I think the time was 12 and 14 years ago on some of these changes, but we're here, we're not there.
Right.
Mrs. Brewer, how do you think the organization, I know it's difficult for you to speak for the organization about talking first, but if you could give us a feeling of, we were talking about putting something in that would require that that new owners honor existing leases up to a certain period of time, 6 months to a year, for people who are already in a property and then it's sold, so they're not automatically evicted, you know, with that kind of short notice.
I think they're very happy to have the existing tenants there.
So
yeah,
you don't think that would be a big problem because then they would just pay to the new landlord. And
I don't see that's a big problem.
Okay.
As far as paying interest on security deposits, the legal services man brought that up. No, we have to put that money in a rental trust account. That's required. Okay. Now on that, I give them my social security number, and the bank sends their year-end statement, their 1099 or whatever it is to me, then I pay the income tax on that amount.
I see. So your point is that you're paying taxes
on it. Yeah,
I've
already paid taxes on it.
It'd be difficult.
That's paying twice.
And giving it back from, It's interesting point. Representative Linder?
I don't think you may pay taxes on it originally, but then you can recover it later when you pay it later.
Oh, okay. So if I pay it out and then it's an expense again.
So what you're saying, you just credit that towards your total tax obligation. It wasn't actual earned income, right?
Right. There may be another way, and that is to put it in a trust for them, but with you being the signatory to withdraw it with their number, and that way it gets credited to their accounts originally. That would probably be an easier way.
Ah.
And but they can't withdraw it without your signature. And that may be an interesting little thing, just so the 1099s match up with the filings.
I don't have very many tenants, four maximum, so that wouldn't be too. And the three-bedroom apartment, they don't change very often, so that would not be too bad for me, although it might be somebody else.
Mrs. Brewer, Mr. Hickerson, who represented Alaska Legal Services, mm-hmm. they provide free legal advice for tenants. Of course, the landlords have to pay for their legal advice. Do you have an idea what the average cost of an eviction procedure, if you were to go to an attorney and hire him to do it, would cost you?
No, I couldn't tell you.
I'd appreciate
Maybe
it.
I see two more of our members are
if
here.
If you could talk to your members and get like an estimate for that, I think that would be useful to the committee to have a understanding of the things that you're faced with.
Okay.
Are there any further questions? Thank you for
just the one I asked before, Alice.
Oh, sure, I'll be glad to look that over.
Unless you don't get a permanent fund dividend or care about it.
Don't just look it over now. You have to return it.
Alice, before you go, are you going to be around? Because I'd love to talk. There's something else about the neighborhood I wanted to talk to you about before you.
I'm Eugene Devine. Hope I'm pronouncing that right.
I'll be right back.
Sure.
If you pronounce that right, Representative Conway.
Thank you.
Is he in the Navy?
He was
in the Navy?
Yeah.
Right him on. What was he, Chief?
They're talking about war stories here.
I could top any of them.
Were you in the Navy?
Well, let me say this, Mr. Boucher. I belong to the Fleet Reserve Association. I'm an honorary member. My Navy experience is confined to the maiden voyage of the USS Alaska, the new submarine. I had the opportunity to ride on it at the invitation of Admiral Rickman from San Francisco to its home port in Bangor, Washington. And if I'm not digressing too far here, I wanted to tell you that it was a very exciting experience. The boat, not a ship, right? The boat.
Yes, they call them boats.
The boat went through all of its
surface man.
Went through all of its maneuvers, diving and all that sort of thing. They do it just like they do in the movies. You know, they honk the horn and crash dive and all that sort of thing. So that's my experience in the Navy. I know it can't top yours.
But we don't want to hear about
it. It does top mine. I've never been below 1 meter except in a crash aircraft, and I didn't like that, and I was only about 20 feet down.
It was a marvelous experience. And let me tell you, the taxpayers get your money's worth from what I've seen in my experience in the submarine service.
Yes, they do.
getting back to business, much of what Mrs. Brewer said, I agree with. I don't think of any changes that I could make other than what she has already discussed. I was impressed, though, by Mr. Hickerson's remark that he has a staff of 26 people. Most of our people are more or less mom and pop operations. I consider myself more or less average. I only have two duplexes, in other words, four units. So I can't speak too extensively, but I do believe that these changes that are being proposed are certainly a long time coming and will be most welcomed by the housing rental owners. I was interested in this remark about, or this proposal, or this idea, this thought that tenants should pay, or should receive the interest on their security deposit. Well, first of all, it doesn't amount to much. I think that we only get about a 5% on a passbook savings, which we have to put into trust. And it really doesn't amount to much, I think around $15 a year. But the problem which I worry about, and Mr. Lehman made the solution, I don't know, but the interest, where I, like Mrs. Brewer brought up, I'm paying income tax on that, and I was not aware of any solution to the problem. I just didn't think it was fair that the tenant got the interest, and I paid the taxes on it. So I have wondered about the fairness of that. I don't know of any landlord that does pay the interest on it, and I think that there's no objection to it, but it's the bookkeeping part. And, you know, the banks are required, as my tax expert tells me, that they have to report that to the Fed, and they get pretty upset sometimes if you don't report even the dollars and cents of some of those small interest things. I believe that's about all that I can say, except that I certainly endorse these changes, and I hope you can persuade your fellow legislators to go along with them. So thank you very much for having the chance to talk to you.
Appreciate you being here. Record should reflect we've been joined by Representative Collins. Are there any questions for the witness? Representative Lehman?
Have you ever gone through an eviction procedure where, you know, tenants haven't paid, or you've actually had to either do it yourself or hire an attorney and go through this procedure?
Yes, I have.
Would you mind telling us approximately how much that procedure cost you?
In my recollection, I was not prepared to discussed that matter this morning, but my recollection was in excess of $400. But that was only the beginning. These people left junk cars in the property, parked them out in the backyard. Only one was visible from the street. And I had to call the Alaska Towing and Wrecking. And these cars were basket cases, and they had to back up a large truck with kind of the end gate that drops down, then you had to hook a cable up and pull it aboard this flatbed truck. And that cost $50 per car, and they got to keep the car. So not only do you evict tenants, you have sometimes the opportunity to evict cars, too. That's bad news. Also, when they had to drag these cars aboard, they were inoperative, and a lot of them tore up parts of the lawn. That had to have some attention, had to be reseeded, and so on and so forth. That's as far as I can describe my experience with the eviction and the cost of it.
Yeah. Okay, I guess one question that would come to mind, you seem like a just average landlord to me.
I consider myself average.
How long after you give them a notice?
Well, it depends upon my own good judgment. I try to be considered if they've got some small financial problem. But if it goes beyond 2 weeks, then I really start getting into a sweat, and I tell them that, I've got to have my money or there will be an eviction notice. But I think I'm very liberal along that line, but I know that I've been taken to the cleaners on that several times by being too liberal.
Yeah, see, that's, if I can editorialize a little bit here, that's my point about this. The average landlord simply does not give a notice to terminate on the first if they don't get the rent. Most of them are normal people, and they have compassion, and they hope that it's a day late, or it's 2 days late, or that people can pay, and they put it up throughout. And if you wait for 2 weeks, then you give your notice, then it's 10 days more you got to wait before you can even get a court hearing, which there's an automatic extension that's available to the defendant for another series of days. And so pretty soon the whole month has gone by. That's
been my experience. I'd say that was correct. In fact, I could even go a step beyond that, because then once they're evicted, then you have to call in the tradesman to come in and to put it in shape again. Then you got to put it in the market, and you have to filter through all these applicants that are trying to rent the place, or if you're lucky, you probably lose another month's rent.
Yeah. So in a way, I think that having shorter periods will actually give landlords more flexibility, because the landlords who have really been stung, I think, are starting to get more and more stringent about giving the notices right on the first day. I mean, just to protect themselves as much as possible. Still is a long time before anything happens. But by having shorter periods, I think you actually give them more flexibility, you know, to deal with it in a reasonable fashion, because they don't have to have this threat over their head of having such a long period of legal, once you start the legal process, they have to wait so long.
I only know of one person that I talk to, and whether he actually does this or not, I don't know what he says. If he comes trying to collect the rent, he has an eviction notice with him. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't get the rent, well, it's there, but they still have 10 days to come up with the money, so it still isn't any kind of a black-hearted landlord approach, I don't think.
Just simply an adjustment to comply with the law.
Yeah, right, except that they mean business on this now, but there's been a change from when I first got into this business. The picture was entirely different. It was places were hard to find to rent. Now, some tenants couldn't care less if you give them an eviction notice. Some of them are like it, because they're going to get out of the rent. Just move out and move to another place.
Any other questions from Mr. Pickleston?
What do you generally charge for deposits in relationship to the monthly rent?
Half a month's rent.
Half a month's rent, and no first and last. So if someone, let's say the rent was $400, all someone would have to pay for a deposit is $200.
That's right.
And they wouldn't have to pay first and last month's rent.
Well, they'd have to pay the first
No.
month. Right, but first and last, they wouldn't have
That'd
to pay.
That would be nice, but I don't do it that way.
Do you, one of the things this bill does is, instead of an approach like yours, which is half of a month's rent, it would increase the maximum to 3 times the first month's rent, so that if the rent was $400, you could get $1,200 deposit out of someone. Do you see any need for that, or does it sound?
Yeah, I can see a need for that in some cases. In others, not at all. I think it would work quite a hardship on some people to come up with that amount of a deposit, but if everybody's doing it, then they can just carry it from one over to the other. But I've found that even a half month's rent is, in some cases, hard to come up with. But it certainly won't cover any kind of a damage that's done. My gosh, these tradesmen come in there and charge $75 an hour just to show up.
Is that the reason you don't go to a full month? The equivalent of a full month's rent, because it'd be too hard to rent it under those circumstances?
Well, there again, I consider myself a soft-hearted landlord, and I've found that some people have a pretty tough time coming up with the rent, with the security deposit, if it went beyond half a month's rent.
I only bring it up as that it seems like a reasonable means to help deal with this problem you've got right now, which is having to consider giving eviction notices early, because you don't want to be stuck with losing out on too much. And obviously, if you have more of a deposit, that's less of an issue.
Well, there's probably some thinking along that line, it'll be all right. But frankly, I don't think that a half a month's rent is enough, because the amount of damage that some people can do that won't even scratch the surface to have that those damages repaired.
Yeah. It's the problem is that the marketplace won't bear it, too.
That's
it'd be
right.
Hard to get it in this particular market.
Very hard.
Any further questions?
President Boucher.
Generally, we've talked about a recession. Are we pulling out of it as far as your group of people are concerned?
Well, the only yardstick I can measure it by is I watched the newspaper classified ad, and I've noticed there has been, I can detect a slight increase in the asking price of rental units. That's the only thing I could offer Representative Boucher.
Further questions?
Thanks for your testimony today. Appreciate
you
coming by.
The opportunity to appear.
Don't want to leave the Navy out.
All right.
Grab one of those.
Thank you.
I'm scared to try out your name here.
Jerry.
Okay, Jerry, why don't you come on up? Now, Bill Dole's out.
Get him into it.
I was really brave, I'd say.
Does Harrington have one of these? Harrington?
No. Got to be heard?
Jerry Harrington?
Yes.
Okay.
I prepared a letter addressed to the committee. Maybe
sure.
I could just give that with you.
Thank you.
We could copy it.
You want to just state your name for the record?
Okay, my name is Jerry Lee Gottfried, and I appreciate your time. I am a landlord, just a small operator. I only have 10 apartments and 3 buildings. I do think that the landlord-tenant law needs to be revised. Any law needs to be revised periodically to make it more relevant to today's problems and more fair. I would like to see this bill passed. If you were to make any amendments, I would, things usually do get amended. I would like to see the notice period for time to quit, which is now 10 days. The bill proposes 7, and if you were to make amendments, I would suggest 5 days. That would be, there may be some people who would say that would create a hardship, and I disagree. I think the present law, 10 days, is much too liberal. As far as the hardship goes, I think people can deal with things if they know, they can deal with things if they know about them. They know the rent's going to be due, and they've only got 5 days. They'll deal with it. I've been listening to your questions. I have had an eviction recently this summer. I chose not to use an attorney because of the money. I didn't feel I could afford it. Oh, okay. Thank you. I did have to seek some advice and ended up with about $100 in attorney and other legal fees, and then there was other filing fees and service fees. But just the attorney, I did as much as I could myself. Just the attorney was about $100 just to review documents that I prepared myself. It took me 22 days to get possession of the apartment. I gave him notice on the 1st. This particular tenant, they were nice people, but they had some kind of chronic financial problems. And I'd actually given them other notices in the past, and they would take the notices down and get government aid. So when the rent wasn't available on the 1st, I was prepared to act. And they could have still continued to live if they would have brought the rent up, except after I gave them the notice for non-payment, I found out that there had been some damages that I didn't approve of that, well, just weren't called for. And then at that point, I no longer would have accepted the rent had they come up with money from the welfare. And I went ahead with the eviction procedure.
Were you, I just had a question, because that's part of this legislation, and I noticed in your letter you referenced it too. Did they offer you some money at some point in time? And
no.
Because as I understand the law now, it's pretty unclear, but it seems like if you were offered a partial payment, even for money that was already owed to you from even a previous month, then that would stop your current action and you'd have to start over again.
That is my understanding of the law, and I don't like that. I would like the...
should be able to accept partial payment and
right.
Continue with your action, yeah. Because it's already owed you, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? We really appreciate you putting your remarks in written form. It's very helpful to us, sir. Thank you very much.
All right.
I do have one
question.
What's the general amount of deposit you asked for in relationship to rent?
The rental market's been has had an oversupply lately, and I've been only able to get about a half a month's rent. Lately, the market's been improving, and I've been trying to increase that. I would like to get a month or even a month and a half. The buildings that I have, the level, the quality that they are, I don't think I could get much more. Even in a good market, I couldn't get much more than a month and a half. I support the increase to 3 months. Even if the market doesn't allow it, it would be nice to have. And there's a lot of times the amount of deposit you can get in a market and would want depends on the quality of the unit you have. Garages and the newness and that type of thing. And I would like to see the law give us the opportunity to get 3 months. If the market wants it, and if the property wants it.
Great, thank you.
Okay, further questions? Representative Lehman?
I'm just going to note that your 22 days is probably on the fast side for an eviction. I went through a procedure, and I don't remember the number of days, but I'm confident if I go back and check the records, it was well over a month, and I probably was like Mr. Devine, soft-hearted and waited until too late till I realized I'd been had and then started the process.
Well, as I said, though, these people had had kind of a chronic problem, so I was sort of prepared. And now that I've worked through the procedure, this was my first complete FED procedure. And now that I've worked through it, the next time it'll be shorter, not by much, but I can shorten it up a couple more days. However, at the present time, I don't have any tenants that I would give a notice to on the first, even if they were late. Every tenant I have now, I would try to work with, depending on their story, for a few days.
About how long would you?
That depends on their story, and that depends on the tenant.
And that's just the history of the tenant.
Exactly.
You trust them.
Yeah, I think that's a real important point when we look at the times. Just it seems to be real common practice that people just don't give notices automatically in the first. Yeah. Did you have to get a writ of assistance to get into the apartment on your 22 days?
I had it available to me. But I did not need to use it. It appeared that they left the night before, from what I could tell.
Okay.
And I just had rather than use that writ of assistance, I just had a friend come over with me, and we went ahead and they had gone.
Okay. For the benefit of the committee, if the court has ordered the tenant to evict and they still refuse to go, then you can obtain a writ of assistance, and the state troopers, given they've got the available time, which they don't always have, will come and assist you to remove the people under the court order. But that's the final step that has to be taken in any eviction process. It could extend for another few days, the process.
Well, you see, the information I had when I went through this eviction was you have the writ of execution right along with all the other papers.
Right. Yeah.
You don't wait till you need it to get it. You have it from day one. If you don't need it, that's fine. But the judge signed it. Even though I didn't need it.
Good.
And again, these people, I'd lived in the same building with them. Overall, they were decent people. It was just money. He lost his job, and they struggled on as long as they could, and then when the damage came up, then it was over.
Other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your time, gentlemen.
Just flip it. So far today we've heard from Alaska Legal Services, which of course was opposed to most of the legislation, and we've heard from the representative of the Landlords Association, Mr. Brewer, who supported it for that organization, and several other individuals who supported it.
I support it too, and glad to see it coming. And I wish that some way a landlord could hold some of the possessions of a tenant when you have to evict them and to try to regain some of your costs. I would like to add something. I wonder if you could add something to this bill. You probably know what I'm going to refer to, and that is escrow account. And I'd like to see the state tell these mortgage holders on their escrow accounts that they have to pay interest on them. And the interest would be the prevailing interest at the location where the property under mortgage is located. I know about savings account interest. The rates of your local banks paying the savings account. I know now First National is paying 6%. I don't know how many millions of dollars in escrow accounts being held by these different mortgage places, but in the past it's been quite a few, and it must be. And that's just my suggestion. I wonder if I could go along with this bill.
In other words, not really just for rental property, but for all escrow accounts.
Anybody who's got a mortgage and has an escrow account, they're investing our money, the same as the non-paying interest, you might say. I don't need somebody outside to pay my taxes on the property. I don't need them to pay my insurance. I can do it myself. And if I do it myself, I can be drawing 6% interest in the First National Bank in the savings account. Right now, I'm paying all this money in an escrow account. My mortgage is small compared to others, but I'm not getting any interest, and my money is not being, I have no use of that on my money. But the mortgage holder, whichever the company might be, they're investing my money and using it, not paying me anything. I can pay my bills. I don't need them to pay my bills. This is my idea. I thank you for your time. I'm sorry I didn't get here sooner to hear what's going on.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? Thanks for coming by, Charlie.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that's all the people we have signed up to testify in 309. I would, if we have any discussion, I was going to work with staff and try to develop some language on the honoring leases provision that new owners or the banks that have took over property would have to honor existing leases for a certain period of time to protect the residents from getting kicked out with real short notice, and try to get some language on that. And
give me a time period to fix that.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for from the committee, with some guidance. Do we think that's a good idea? It seems like even it might even benefit the new property owners. They seem to support it because they've got people in there, and it doesn't seem to be onerous on any new owners.
I have mixed feelings.
I see some benefit to it, but I think in extending it as long as 6 months, you're tying up the hands of an owner for a fairly long time, depending if, you know, you always have the ability, I think, to go in and make improvements. I think that's probably the one way around it. And evict for improvements, and then that just forces them to take another approach. But I think when somebody buys a property, they may have something else in mind, and I think forcing them to honor a lease for that long may be somewhat limiting. Although I do see some benefit, of course, to the people staying there, you know, to have ample time to make plans. And if I were that landlord, that new one, I think it'd be good to have a seasoned, well-paying tenant there. But I guess I just want to make sure that we're not being too restrictive. And I don't know if Mrs. Brewer's had time, she might want to take that back to her association and discuss it there instead of just a somewhat off-the-cuff response to it, to see what a number of these small-time property owners, how they respond to it.
Okay. Well, Mrs. Brewer, you're going to be talking to your group about that, right? See how they feel about it, of course.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Are you talking about when the property's gone into foreclosure and the bank takes it over?
Yeah.
And sounds to me you're talking about the property when someone else has purchased it. Are those two different things?
Well, okay. Well, those exchanges, I was talking about both, actually. I guess the biggest problem right now is that, in this economy, is when a bank takes it over and just cancels all of it. Because a lot of banks don't want to manage property. I've seen where they've taken over a fourplex and just canceled, just evicted everybody.
And so the unit then goes empty.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make sense.
But you see, the banks aren't set up to manage property. They just don't want to deal with it. They'd rather have it empty. I've seen it, like a whole street of that before. And I've talked to the people, says, oh, yeah, the bank just gave us 30 days notice. We got to be out of here. And, you know, we don't want to go, but they don't want to manage this property. Which is kind of a terrible situation.
It's a real hardship for people, I think, particularly like military families who have moved up here and everything just gotten them so situated and have a 1 or 2 year lease in a short period of time. It works a real hardship on people.
Yeah.
30 days may not be enough time, although in this, and it would depend on the market. I think if you have a market like today, 30 days might not be bad because there is a lot of property available, but if you have a tight market, then 30 days isn't going to be enough to find a suitable place.
Yeah.
Plus it's going to pay for the expenses of relocation.
Once the framework of the language is drafted, the time is easy. You can take, 1 month, 2 months, whatever. I have a question, though. If a tenant has the right, if the lease stays in effect for a certain period of time after the property changes hands, do you want to obligate the tenant to honor the lease? You're obligating the landlord to honor the lease for that certain period of time. Do you also want to obligate the tenant? Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Or is that even necessary?
Well, if you're going to obligate, both parties should be under obligation if they mutually release.
Okay.
If they both want out, they should both be able to get out. But if either one of them wants to hold the other in, they should hold.
Isn't this mostly an issue with foreclosures? Because if someone, I guess this is a question. If someone buys a piece of property that's subject to a lease, I assume they have to assume the lease is one of the liabilities that they can't.
Well, see, Mr. Hickerson's testimony was that they don't.
When they buy?
When they buy, they don't have to do that.
It's sort of strange if if someone's got a right-of-way or they've got any other use of it, you're obligated to that.
Yeah, but I guess the common law principle, which would apply if we don't have any statutory law on it, is that your rights as a tenant only came from the rights that the person you bought the rights from had. As soon as their rights are probably terminated, you no longer have a claim. You might have a claim against the former landlord if you can find them, or something, but you don't have any, you're not entitled to possession of the dwelling anymore.
Yeah, well, I do think you're right, that should be addressed.
Well, we're going to draft up some language and then we can play around with the time, make a decision as a committee.
have one further question, Representative Donnelly, and I don't want to complicate the issue, but what do you do in a circumstance where a landlord, say, that owns a fourplex, knows that they're about to be foreclosed on, and for any reasons ranging from financial gain or perversity, enter into a lease, a two-year lease agreement with their four tenants at a substantially lower price than what the market would bear?
Well, then what you've got a time frame. The lease, you'd only go into the first whatever time the committee would agree on of the lease. I mean, the length of the agreement isn't relevant unless it's shorter than the time frame of the law that we would adopt.
That's a good point that Jensen raises, though. Binding somebody to an obligation that would be inappropriate. But I guess if we made that time frame short enough.
Yeah. And a purchaser ought to know that, too. I don't know what they're getting into. A financial institution would be in a little bit more of a disadvantage. If I was a purchaser, I'd always know what the contracts were for the property I was purchasing, where I got in. It seems to be a major topic. Any time I've seen people who have thought about buying rental property, they were very interested in who the tenants were, what the term of the leases were, what the terms of the leases were.
Representative Donald,
sure.
Can I have a copy here of the class of statute, and the remark was made about a two-year lease. And I was told there is no such thing as a two-year lease.
The 1 year, isn't it?
It says right here, if the rental agreement given by the operation of this section provides for a term longer than 1 year, it is effective only for 1 year.
Yeah. Now, Ginger, in commercial property, you can go longer. But that's residential.
Right. Is there any reason why you could not have a different time limit in a circumstance where a bank foreclosed on property or where a person outright purchased a property?
No, you could do that. You could do that by statute.
But this amendment that you want drafted, it would be solely to require that anybody who's the new owner has to honor a lease for a certain period of time.
Why don't we start there, and then we can think about if we want to fine-tune it for a distinction. We want to talk to some of the other different folks who've been impacted by it. We'll start from a general point, and we'll just work on it.
We might want to, as long as we're just chatting, but I might add, talk to some of these financial institutions and get somebody in to, or at least by teleconference, if you take this up, don't take it up again until we're in Juneau, and get a response from them on what the impact will be.
We'll try to talk to them.
Or we can handle it.
Do you want any language drafted regarding the interest payments?
How does the committee feel about that? We've heard the arguments both sides. The reason I've talked to Mr. Lippitt about this before, and the thing that's always seemed to stymie this before is the bookkeeping problems, and it's always run into strong opposition from the banking community. It seems like it's basic fairness that if you hold somebody else's money, they should get the interest from it. The argument on the other side is that it's usually so minuscule, it's not a significant enough amount to justify the bookkeeping and the difficulty of it. I see the basic fairness of the argument.
Isn't there a non-interest-bearing account? Is there an account, a separate account that you could put this money into that would satisfy the law, the requirement that it has to be kept separate from your own income, but put it in a non-interest-bearing account?
Yeah, I guess, but that's the same thing, isn't it? That's just preventing one of the parties from gaining unnecessarily from it. You've still denied the people who the money really belongs to.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good idea. I'm not sure how to solve the bookkeeping problem, but we may be able to find a way.
Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we take a let's look at what some of the states have done that have done this, because I know some other states have done this, and we could ask House Research to give us a little spill on this, because I think they've done it before, and we could get that information before the committee, so we could take a look at that and see if it makes sense.
Sure. I think in basic fairness, I don't have any problem with paying interest on a security deposit. I'm confident, though, a landlord spends more than $15 worth of effort to make that exchange, and so really what it is just another burden on the landlord, but it's a small one, and it's more of a symbolic gesture, I think, and I think that's what Mr. Hickson's asking for. We're talking about a pretty small amount of money.
You were talking about a person who has just one rental property, who's benefiting 6% on $15 or whatever, or on $500. That's different than someone who has many rental properties and is accruing a lot of, you know, benefit. You might look at it that way in terms of, if you're just a one person, you know, if you're just one person who's renting one piece of property and you're only gaining maybe $15 a year in interest, well, that's different than someone who's making several hundred dollars, you know, on interest. And
you know, we might make a break with somebody who has like 10 or more rental units has to enter in that, because they become more sophisticated. The more rental units, the more...
They're already doing more bookkeeping.
Yeah, they're already doing more, and they got more knowledge about how to do it. If somebody just has an extra house they rent, you know, they've got an old house or something that's been in the family for years. And they rent it, they're not going to be sophisticated enough to think about setting up all these separate components or really study the Landlord-Tenant Act. It might be a really good approach for example.
You know, another idea, too, is you could just have the interest paid out to be the interest minus any taxes paid on it. You just pay that out, because theoretically, if the tenants had the money in their own account and they made the money, they'd have to pay tax themselves. So they're getting...
How would you know what the taxes were?
Just assume maximum rate.
You'd have to... Of course, our federal tax rates change, but maybe you could just assume 28%.
Say... Give them back 62% of the value or something like that. Just assume that.
Yeah, that might be a simple way to do it. Because that's, they're not going to, if they got their own interest, they wouldn't be getting it all anyway. They'd be getting taxed. So, of course, it does get confusing, right?
Well, I think that's, let's look at what other states are doing. Let's contact House Research. I bet they've already got some reports on this, because this issue has come up before. And then let's look at this concept of when somebody's a really active landlord and they've got multiple units, then maybe having them have that burden and not just the individual owners.
You may want to look at a total dollar amount in monthly rentals as opposed to the number of units.
Yeah.
Somebody might have 10 units, but if they're renting for $150 a month, they may not be making sufficient interest to be worthwhile.
That's cool.
I'll talk with you.
Okay.
From
the college.
Alaska Legal Services opposed to the bill. Did they submit anything in writing?
No, they said they would go through a section by section and yeah, I didn't want to go through a section by section discussion with Mr. Hickerson at this time. There's a lot of things that in the bill it just seems like they shouldn't have real problems with when they sit down and go through it. I think their basic objection was the whole concept, you know, because they're looking at it from their point of view, which is they represent low-income tenants. And I think what I tried to do today is get them to think about it from a couple different levels. And when they do their analysis, tell us, well, this really isn't relevant for the high-income market, but for the people we represent, this might be a problem. Because I think there's a lot of places there might be a dichotomy there, too.
Okay. Anything else on this piece of legislation? All right. Well, we really appreciate you being here today. I want to take like about a 5-minute break, and then I want to come back and talk about the revolving door legislation, just real short. Okay? Okay, we'll reconvene the meeting. The next subject on the agenda this morning is the revolving door legislation proposal. And Ginger, you're thinking, could you address the committee a little bit about revolving door, and you want to take a...
Sure. Just very briefly, in your committee files, probably the most helpful piece would be a memorandum from Representative Downing to members of the committee dated November 23rd. It lays out the provisions in the draft legislation. In general, revolving door legislation deals with any restrictions or conditions that's placed on a public employee that is entering back into private employment. We have some general restrictions under Alaska statute and administrative procedures through the ethics code. there are three things, or two things that the current draft deals with. The first is very specific to the director of the Division of Insurance, and it requires that the director cannot hold an ownership interest in an insurance company for 1 year before or after serving as director of the Division of Insurance. When the drafter first did that, she called me and asked if I also wanted to make a restriction that they can't have an ownership interest in an insurance company while they serve as a director. And it hadn't occurred to me to specify that, but that is specified in the bill. So a year before, after, or while they are serving as a director, they can't have an ownership interest in an insurance company. The second part of the draft deals with is a prohibition against any public employee of any level that was directly involved in a procurement. Cannot work for the company or person who was the recipient of that procurement for 1 year after they leave state employment. All right, in your file, there's also a draft bill that Representative Gruenberg was considering introducing that prohibits commissioners, deputy commissioners, or directors from lobbying for 2 years after leaving state employment. He has not introduced that bill and would just assume if the committee is going to introduce revolving door legislation that that provision be rolled into the committee bill and that it go as a package. Attached in the behind this memorandum besides the draft bill, there is a multi-state survey that was given to us by NCSL that talks about other states and what they're doing in these kinds of revolving door restrictions. Most of them are dealt with in some sort of ethics code, but some states have adopted separate restrictions on specific circumstances. Also in your file is an excerpt from a report by Robert Hunter, who is the president of the National Insurance Consumer Organization, and he specifically recommends some revolving door restrictions on the insurance regulators, and that's where that was the spark for the draft that you have before you.
Representative Gruenberg's suggestion, but we didn't know he was working on this on his own, and he suggested we try to integrate his proposal with the proposed committee legislation, and what I'd propose to do is try to work that out with him, try to pull them together into one proposed bill and then bring it back before the committee for its consideration of whether or not we want to do it as a committee bill.
What's his bill do again? It says you can't be a lobbyist.
A person may not become a lobbyist for at least 2 years after leaving the state office if the person served as commissioner or deputy commissioner of a department in executive branch or director of a division within the department of executive branch.
In my thoughts, 2 years is a pretty long time, but I try to work something out with Max and Representative Collins.
I have a question. Under the bill that's proposed, what is the definition for public employee?
Any public employee. I mean, of any grade, for instance.
So that'd be like legislative staff?
That would include legislative staff. It would not include railroad workers. They're not public employees under the definition of the Transfer Act, transferring ownership of the air.
To with regard to the restriction on the insurance director, I don't really have a problem with that, but I think that if these types of restrictions, if they don't apply to other agency heads, they should. And the reason is that most of the time, it would seem to me that when a governor is appointing somebody to these positions, that they're appointing people to an area that hopefully they have some expertise or some ability in. And so it would seem to me that probably when the governor would appoint an insurance director, that he would want that person to have some background and knowledge in the area of insurance, and hopefully some of it would be recent. I don't have any problem, you know, with basically the legislation, but I'm thinking that it would be appropriate for maybe all appointed positions that the person, you know, if you take somebody who's in commerce, that and you appoint somebody to commerce, you obviously want someone who's in the business community and all those kinds of things. And to me, any concern with regard to ethics should be the same for someone in that position as someone in the insurance commissioner position. So I don't have a problem with you know, with these restrictions on the insurance director, but I think they ought to be on anybody at that level.
Well, you know where I'm coming from. I'm not so concerned about what they did before they came into office as during office and after office. Mm-hmm. Also, the reason insurance directors really set out here is because they're kind of a unique position in our state government. Mm-hmm. Most states have an insurance commissioner, and they're autonomous agencies.
Mm-hmm. Many are elected.
Yeah, many are elected. We have an insurance director, mm-hmm. and it's the only employee under the Department of Commerce that has a semi-autonomous status from the Commissioner of Commerce. In other words, the Commissioner of Commerce, under the statutes, really can't order the insurance commissioner, the insurance director, to do things like he would order the director of tourism to do. It's a really unique position because of that. Also, one of the real concerns here is I don't know if I would support these provisions for commissioner of commerce or a general commissioner position as much as I would for director of insurance, because director of insurance is a regulator, actually sits and makes quasi-judicial judgments about what goes on in that industry. That regulatory function is the function that concerns me the most, not policy-making function. Because when you make a specific decision you're making about a specific company in a specific case, this is authorized, this isn't, you did bad, you did okay, versus we think the company should be doing this or shouldn't be doing that. I think those are different levels. And when you get into that regulatory function, that's when I start to really become concerned about the appearance of impropriety when they go from a direct regulatory function to a working back in that industry for one of those same companies that they just made a specific decision on. So if we can find other, I certainly would support what your suggestion for other types of regulatory functions in the government. I think they should come up to the same level.
Or maybe the thing is to maybe, if possible, change the manner in which they currently work and make them be, you know, somewhat responsible to the directors of the Commissioner of Commerce. If the problem is that they have, you know, a lot of autonomy, and that might present some problems with regard to conflict of interest or ethics, that maybe the thing that you want to do is put some reins on that autonomy to reduce that ability, as opposed to saying you can't do this or you can't do that. It would seem to me a little bit cleaner. But I would think that some of these restrictions would apply to other areas, and we ought to look at that as well. I mean, I'm not objecting to these.
Yeah.
I want to be real clear about that, but I'm just saying that I think they're, you know, just think sitting here looking at it, it's applicable to other areas as well.
Mr. Chairman. When I read the restrictions on the insurance director, I'm a little bit troubled that we would be quite so restrictive. For example, owning any interest in an insurer would mean that anybody who owned a mutual fund, which may be invested in an insurance company, would technically be ineligible to serve. I own some mutual funds. While I get statements as to what they're invested in, I will be frank that I don't spend a whole lot of time reviewing them. Most of the time, I chuck them in the wastebasket without even opening them, or I open and look, and I go, oh, that's fine. And I would guess that other people do the same thing. And we have people now with the ability to set up self-employment plans, IRAs, KEOs, and other abilities to manage funds, where mutual funds have become a pretty normal way of investing to diversify one's portfolio, even though they may be small portfolios. And I wouldn't, you know, for myself, it wouldn't taint my judgment at all in how I